Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does food tie us to our religious and family heritage? As both Thanksgiving and the start of Hanukkah approach next week, families across the country are laying in supplies to create dishes that represent more than just a way to satisfy our physical appetites. And as we cook things our families have been making for generations of special occasions, many of us will also have children with us in the kitchen, which my guest today sees as a perfect opportunity for teaching them not only about ingredients and techniques, but about their culture. Tina Wasserman is a cooking instructor specializing in contemporary kosher foods, and she's the author of the new book, Entree to Judaism for Families, Jewish Cooking and Kitchen Conversations with Children. Tina, welcome back to Think.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Tell me about your earliest memories of cooking when you were a child.
My earliest memory, the family always talked about this. It was the early 50s when prices of food were very expensive. And my mother walked in, and I was 3 years old, and I'm sitting on the floor with a dozen eggs, a five-pound bag of flour, and a rolling pin, and I was going to make a pie. So that really probably was a portent of things to come. But it really, my earliest recollection of cooking is I was about 9 years old. We had just moved, and our new neighbor was a woman who had just been widowed, had three boys, and she had the consummate cookie jar. Hmm. And so she took me under her wing and taught me how to bake. And I still have the hand typed on the old pressed real hard on the keys index cards of recipes that I typed up. You know, so that's my earliest recollection of cooking, and it was a very formidable for me because it was very important. It really forced me to look at what I love to do the most, and here I am.
You know, and it's so funny about cooking with children because I have memories of cooking with my grandmother, and I didn't realize at the time that a lot of what she was making was tied back into her own heritage. She made a lot of German foods.
Right.
I didn't get that. I just knew that she made really good noodles and dumplings and things like that. And then later, as I've gotten older, I've realized what a heritage she presented me with.
Do you have any of her recipes?
I do, actually. And she wrote some things out for me multiple times because when I was a kid, I would lose the cards. But the thing that she made that we still eat to this day that only my sisters and I will touch are these eggs pickled with beets and vinegar. Mm-hmm. And they're bright purple and they're hard-boiled. And any of the men who've married into the family think that it is absolutely insane that we have to have these, but we have them every year.
Do you have them every year because you love them or the memory?
It's a little bit of both. Honestly, I could go the rest of my life without biting into one, but it takes us back. You know?
Exactly. It's I don't remember cooking with my grandmother, but I have such distinct memories of my grandmother cooking certain foods when the family got together that I've talked about this to many people. When I was about 14 years old, she had a heart attack, and we thought that she was going to pass away, and she didn't. She survived it. And at 14, I watched my relatives sitting around her hospital bed talking about her knishes. And it struck me at that age that they were realizing that when she went, so went something that was so a part of their lives. And later on, I recreated the recipe. But the point was it really – that's when I realized that there was such a strong connection to memory with food.
Well, I grew up – I spent my childhood in Long Island, so I know what a knish is. But there may be people listening
Absolutely.
That have no idea what this thing is. So let's talk about that.
Okay. Well, the knish that is more commercially available usually at football games and baseball games, certainly on the East Coast, is basically a mashed potato that's mixed with spices, sometimes a little bit of sautéed onion, and then it has a crust on it that, and usually the ones that most people are exposed to are square. They were created by a company called Gubilas years ago. I mean, decades and decades and decades ago, and that seems to be the gold standard. The knishes my grandmother made were the dough was mashed potato and the filling was fried onion. So, but again, it was, you will find, she was from Romania, and you will find that as you get from Romania to the Middle East, the concept or the love of stuffing vegetables with fillings was not only practical because there was a plethora of vegetables available, but it was also something that was culturally, you could see it centered in that area.
Well, and stuffing anything with anything else seems to always be a good idea. It's sort of universally popular throughout a lot of cultures. And
absolutely,
you have a number of different recipes in the book for crepe luck.
Mm-hmm. Yes. The classic recipe for crepe luck usually has beef filling. But again, there is always, as my students would always tease me, there's always a method to my madness. There's a reason why I did chicken crepe luck, because unless you've kept your shards of brisket from when you're slicing your brisket during the year, unless you've kept them in a freezer bag and then put them in the freezer and had them readily available, certainly with a book that's oriented to children, the last thing you want to do is say, okay, honey, we're going to – and I've seen recipes like this. Start out with a 3-pound piece of brisket. Cook it for 3 hours.
You've
then
lost them
chop
already.
It up. There's no way. That is a deal breaker. That mm-hmm. is a deal breaker for adults. It is certainly a deal breaker for children with their, you know, limited attention span. So I thought, if you're making chicken soup anyway, there is nothing, as far as I'm concerned, there is nothing better than the chicken from the chicken soup, the boiled chicken, for making the best chicken salad ever. And I figured I had this cooked chicken. Why not chop it? And why not put some onion in it? And of course, again, if you're thinking about the 21st century and everybody's looking to eat healthier and maybe there are people that can't eat beef, you know, whatever, bingo, I created a recipe that was true to the history and the tradition, because there is a reason for having the crepe luck or these dumplings that are basically like wonton in a soup for the Jewish New Year.
Yeah, talk about that. You take your wishes for the new year and you sort of seal them up.
Yes, yes. It started in medieval times. Jews would take their wish for the new year, put it on a little bit of paper, put it in some dough, and wear it around their necks as amulets. Hmm. And I fantasized that some Jewish housewife said, I am not wasting this good flour, which was not easy to come by,
yeah.
You know, milled flour, you know, on a necklace. Either
everybody
that,
hand them over and we'll
right,
them
exactly,
in the pot.
Right, exactly, exactly. Either that or she said, honey, why don't you try getting me a nice metal one? And hence the origins of lockets. And who knows, maybe that is, in fact, the origin. But I don't presume that it is.
Mm-hmm. And if you want another sort of shortcut, if you're cooking with kids, is you can use wonton skins.
Yes, absolutely. But I always joke, and this is radio, so people can't see me do it. But, you know, if you use one wonton, then it's going to kind of flip in the water, you
uh-huh.
know, and it's going to be thin. But if you want it to be like your grandmother's, you know, then chances are you should use 2 or 3 wontons as a layer, because then it'll be nice and thick and chewy. However, nowadays, and I will admit that I do make good pasta dough, but when I'm cooking for 115 people for Rosh Hashanah, the last thing I'm doing is making my own dough. I'm happy I'm making crepe luck. You can go, a lot of the supermarkets, the high-end supermarkets, will have fresh pasta dough. Or you can go to companies here in town that make very, very good pasta dough and buy it that way. And so then you can just fill it.
Just cut out the shapes mm-hmm. that you need and, mm-hmm. and go from there. All right, so Hanukkah's coming up.
Yes.
Sort of early this year.
Yes.
And there's this whole conflict with Thanksgiving. It's not a conflict, I guess, but
no.
there's a confluence.
Yes.
First of all, why is Hanukkah so associated with fried foods?
Okay, Hanukkah is associated with fried foods because, and I'm going to
not
give,
that I'm complaining.
No. I'm going to give you two reasons. I'm going to give you the practical reason, and then I'm going to give you the reason that if you ask anybody who is Jewish and grew up in Sunday school, say, "Oh, it's because the vial of oil in the temple that had been desecrated, there was one sealed vial, which meant it was still holy, that was could only last one day." And this, as the story goes, and, you know, I always say, you know, it wasn't just the Greeks that had mythology. So we all have it in every culture. So the oil lasted for 8 days. Now, The reality is that latkes are just about 200 years old. That's it. Because if
I had no idea they were like a relatively recent.
Nobody has. I mean, you know, it's like I'm bursting everybody's bubble. The bottom line is potatoes weren't introduced into Europe until the end of the 1600s, early 1700s. They were then had to take time to learn how to cultivate them and have them last. But the truth of the matter is, first they were used as food for animals. Then they were used as food for prisoners. Then they were used for people who were poor. Now, if you're poor, you could find a potato. You could always find an onion. But what else was going on at the time? In Europe, the geese were being fattened from September for about 3 months until the beginning of December. In December, the geese were slaughtered. The down and the feathers were used for warmth. The meat was made into a confit so that it was preserved and there was food for the winter. Mm-hmm. And all of this rendered fat. And remember, the geese were really fat and they were almost force-fed to fatten them. That was their cooking oil. So if you were poor and if you wanted to make something celebratory, something different, something special to commemorate a holiday, you know, then you can always find a potato. You've got an onion and you've got this fresh goose oil. So bingo, that's how you had latkes. Because the majority of the Jewish world did not eat potato latkes. They subscribed to a different story, and that was the story about the heroine Judith, who knew that the general Holofernes was coming to annihilate the Jews in her community. So she went to his tent with salty cheese and wine, and I presume she was wearing a very voluptuous, you know, dress. And she fed him salty cheese, and he got thirsty and drank wine, and he ate some more cheese and got thirsty, finally fell asleep. And this story is not told in Sunday school so much because supposedly she cut off his head, put it on a staff, went out, scared his army away, and saved the Jews.
There's no coloring books with that
picture.
No,
I don't think so, no. So as a result, the Jews in Italy and a lot of the Mediterranean made cheese pancakes.
And a traditional topping for these is applesauce, which you remind us here that is like the easiest thing you can make from scratch, but nobody does it.
No, and it's fast. It's almost faster than opening up a jar. It's certainly faster than saying, oh, I have no applesauce. I have to go down and go to the supermarket. You know, that is also something that I built into this book to make sure that the recipes were seasonal, for example, so that now not necessarily in a subtle way we're teaching sustainability. But that's not why I did it. I did it because there's no sense saying, honey, let's make something. And they say, oh, great, let's do this recipe with pomegranates, you know, and it's the middle of the summer and there are no pomegranates around. So, but the applesauce, the most delicious and easiest and fastest way to make applesauce without peeling it. So if you're talking about working with even two-year-olds with children, most people have one of those apple slicer cores.
Right.
Okay. So you just press down, cut it into wedges, throw it into a pot. The bottom of the pot should be covered with about a half inch of water. And I say that because it depends on how big a pot you're using. And you're not going to use a six-quart pot if you're using two apples, or one would hope not. So in the book, I specify the size of the pot just to make sure that, you know, nobody messes up. But in any case, you just put it in with the water with one stick of cinnamon. 15 minutes later, you know, you cover the pot. It's steamed. And then one of the least heralded and probably best pieces of equipment. So if those of you are thinking about buying something for a family member for Hanukkah or for Christmas, a food mill. A food mill is a non-electric, it looks like a pot with a handle, but it's a strainer on the bottom.
Let me jump in. We're going to take a quick break here. Sure. My guest is Tina Wasserman. Her new cookbook is called Entree to Judaism for Families, Jewish Cooking and Kitchen Conversations with Children. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Mm.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour to cooking educator Tina Wasserman. Her new book is called Entree to Judaism for Family, Jewish Cooking and Kitchen Conversations with Children. She's got a signing event this afternoon at 1:30, between 1:30 and 3:30 at the Barnes & Noble store at Preston and Royal. If you would like to join our conversation, you can do so by emailing think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. So you were extolling the virtues of the humble food mill.
Yes.
And it's used not only for applesauce, but for a lot of things. Okay, so we've boiled our apples. They're softened up.
You just put them right in the top of the food mill, turn the handle, and this is perfect for developing gross motor coordination in children. And the pulp comes out the bottom, and the skin stays on the top. But there's a layer right underneath the skin that's called the flavor cells. And so you're getting more of the flavor there. And if you have the bright red apples, your applesauce will have a pink tinge to it. And you will not have to add any sugar to it whatsoever, because unless you choose Granny Smith apples, in which case, don't talk to me about it because I don't use Granny Smith apples. But then you can, it's a wonderful flavor. And then you've got it. And for those who are worried about the mashup of Thanksgiving and Hanukkah, and if they are having turkey or, meat at the table and don't want to have sour cream is also used on top of latkes, the applesauce is perfect and it fits in.
Gala apples are the best choice for this kind of applesauce?
I like the Gala or the Fuji, and the Honeycrisp are very good. I think sometimes when you see the price of some varieties of apples that are very, very expensive, psychologically the thought of cooking them down, freaks people out. But what I don't recommend, and of course the apple industry will probably come after me, the Red Delicious.
They look pretty.
That's right. They have been bred at this point to be pretty, to withstand traveling and storage and hold up well, but the flavor is not as concentrated in it as it used to be.
So I have a girlfriend who makes her own bagels at home, which always seemed like when I was growing up, bagels were something you got at the bagel store. There's
right.
No other place to go. It turns out it's not as maybe labor intensive as we might imagine.
It's not only not labor intensive. Kids love to make them. I will tell you that all the food pictures in the book, I cooked. There's no fake anything. There's no glycerin. There's no blowtorches.
No food stylist?
No. Well, I did have a food stylist because we did 64 pictures in 2 days or 2.5 days. So
you need a little help.
Yes. But it was, they came out. The water was great. I mean, and literally, I think when the water table changes, it has an effect on our bread doughs and on our pizza dough and our bagel dough. And that's why everybody says, oh, you can't get this and you have to go to Chicago or you have to go to New York. I think it has to do with the mineral content of the water. But in any case, it came out so good that I started jumping up and down the kitchen. I said, I can't believe this. This bagel is so good. and the photographer and all his assistants, everybody said, well, let's take a break. Where's the butter? But it is. It's very easy because it's also not very time consuming. I think it takes about 20 minutes or so to let the dough rise. And then, of course, the trick to bagels is that they're boiled first. And you put a little sugar in the water. Now, in bakeries, they put a little lye in the water, but I'm not about to give you a recipe with that.
What does the sugar do?
Sugar creates that glistening,
sort of glossy surface.
And that hard surface, because the sugar is on, if the sugar is on the exterior of the dough, when you then go to bake it, it caramelizes right away, so it prevents the dough from rising like bread as much. So it's more concentrated. So the texture of the bagel is more concentrated, and the outside is a little more chewy.
Why did somebody invent bread with a hole in the middle?
It was invented, actually, if you can imagine, for those who didn't grow up with all of these stories out there in the listening audience right now, but if you did see Fiddler on the Roof, you knew what it was like living in what they called shtetls, in little teeny communities where they were very poor. And people would go out to the, if they didn't have businesses in the town, they went out to the fields to work, and they didn't have time nor to come back for lunch, nor did they have the money to bring an elaborate lunch. So a snack was brought out to them by somebody else who was trying to make a living. But that somebody else probably didn't have enough money to have a push cart. But he could make the rolls that he was bringing out there into the shape of a ring. Bagel means ring. And then he put it on a stick. Hmm. And then he just walked out with it. And the first immigrants that came to this country from Eastern Europe in the first major wave at the end of the 1800s, not the first immigrants, they were looking for, you know, again, connection to what they left behind, even if what they left behind was difficult, and they were looking to way to make a living. And so I think that it was purported that at the beginning of the 20th century, there were something like 500 bagel push carts on the Lower East Side area alone. You know, there was a lot of competition.
Would your ancestors be delighted to see the, you know, creamed spinach and focaccia bagel kind of combinations they have today, or would people be horrified by this?
I don't think they could relate to it, You know, but like any other tradition, even bagels morphed a little bit in terms of what they were used for. I mean, if I've just finished telling you that bagels were representative of the poorest of the poor in the community, you know, a food that they ate as a snack, you know, when we think of bagels, very often in this country, we think of bagels, cream cheese, and lox.
I had no idea that that was a New World addition.
Absolutely. And not only was it a New World, but when I say it tells a story, I don't look at food without looking at what was its origin, what was going on at the time, you know, and trying to figure out how it was created. And the truth of the matter is the immigrants who came from Eastern Europe, who came from Russia, and, you know, the white cream cheese was a staple in the southeastern part of Eastern Europe. And lox, smoking was a way of preserving. Certainly, it could not have come from the middle of Europe. It came from countries that bordered on the Black Sea or the Caspian. So You had that, but it also, because it was expensive, it was a rarity. So when somebody came to this country and became successful, they took a food that they knew and loved, the bagel, a food that they knew that was produced near them, and a food that was generally unattainable in the old world, but was represented success in the new world.
Hmm.
And that's basically how you got bagels, cream cheese, and lox.
And I have to say the capers really make it, too.
Yeah, well, the capers had to be some French chef that decided, then we'll chop up a little egg yolk, and then we'll chop up. That's not in this book. I cannot see children. I could see them chopping, but I can't see them having the patience for it.
You know, it's interesting that everything in this book, you can cook it with kids, and you sort of give some tips, like this is great for an older child, this one
right.
You can have with a three-year-old. The dirty little secret for I'm not a particularly experienced cook, and there's a lot of things that adults could try for the first time, whether or not they have a child along with them. Is that part of your thinking?
Absolutely. The book is actually coming out in another format in another week or so, and that is an e-book. And it's the same book, but there is interaction with the recipes. You can actually learn what, you know, my feeling is, a child can look at the word whisk and it's in blue and then click on, you know, run the cursor over and up pops a picture of a whisk. So now you can say to the child, okay, honey, now go over to the drawer over there, you know, or grandma's drawer over there.
And find this thing.
And find this. Mm-hmm. And so then you're talking about child developmental skills. Now, that was the reason I did this. However, every time I explain this to people, mothers usually say, I need that. I want to look at, well, but they'll know that whisk begins with the letter W, which is another thing. Why do we have to teach children the alphabet that A is for apple and B is for ball and C is for cat? Why can't it be W is for whisk and B is for boil? And then they'll see the videos too. But this is definitely a book that can be used. The four families was because I wanted to create a connection. I wanted to create an activity that wasn't dumbed down. Even when I had my Mom and Tots cooking school in Manhattan, and then I actually had it here for a number of years, I did not do dumbed down recipes. So as I said to somebody, I don't do banana snakes. They looked at me. I said, you know, you cut the banana up, glue it together with peanut butter and put two raisins for eyes. And then, oh, isn't that cute? Well, the children of today aren't seeing that on menus and they're being taken to restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
They know. So it is definitely for a learning experience. And the recipes are not necessarily, well, there's none that are religious other than I have a Syrian kharoset. But, you know, that's an unbelievably delicious fruit spread that can be used on toast. So
You say that you've met people who said, why were we not taught more about cooking in Hebrew school? And mm-hmm. I've never heard of that, but it makes perfect sense because there's so much symbolism in Jewish food.
Absolutely. But as it is, for those of us who grew up going to temple three times a week, two nights during the week and one and Sunday. And that didn't even count junior congregation on Saturday.
So that was enough time.
You know, certainly it was enough time for us. And the fact that now there are sports and everything and it's very difficult to even have children come that many days a week. The bottom line is that when a child goes to Hebrew school for an hour and a half after school, they've got to teach them the letters. They've got to teach them the prayers. They have to teach them the tunes. They have to try to teach them what some of the words mean. You know, so it's there's no time for all of this. And in reality, most of the time, the response I get from people is, I never knew that, because people don't know that. So I'm on a mission.
So sweets are always popular at the holidays, and
yes.
You have these cookies that have been served, at least in some places around Hanukkah,
mm-hmm.
Star-shaped cookies. Tell us about that.
Well, it's interesting because the Zimtsterner are served for Hanukkah, and they are also served traditionally they were served for Abdul at the end of the Sabbath. And that the stars were because the Sabbath ends when there are three stars in the sky. I chose to put them in the cookbook because not only are they enjoyable to eat, they're spice cookies, so they really transcend every holiday.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also, they're very old. This particular one is made with honey, so it makes it that hard, not hard, but firm, but chewy.
Yeah.
As opposed to, I did have a Zimtsterner recipe in my first book, which is very crispy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and again, it's cultural, because adding honey automatically changes the consistency. So I thought it was appropriate and nice to have this particular dough. And of course, you don't have to do it in stars. You could cut out little dreidels. You could cut out pumpkins and turkeys, people. It doesn't mean that, you know, I mean, this fighting of the two holidays doesn't have to fight.
What does your Thanksgiving table look like?
A groaning board.
is it different every year, or are there like
no.
nine things that you always cook?
Well, this is a very, very important point that you're bringing out. Whether or not, even if I'm not having Thanksgiving in my home, and this year I'm actually going to very old dear friends because I have to be in Washington for signing, but it is very, very, and this is the best thing I can tell your audience. Even though I'm so into, exploring and trying new things, but I try to teach tradition, you do not mess with the family's recipes. Now, the reason I say that is in my first book, I have a recipe for sweet potato pumpkin casuela that is made with coconut milk and a little bit of spice, and it's out of this world. But if your family is expecting to see the sweet potato casserole that you've always made with the marshmallows on top, do not substitute. Mm-hmm. You may put two on the table, one of each kind, because usually you have to double or triple a recipe anyway for your Thanksgiving meal. And then if somebody says, if they decide this is so much better than the one with the margarita, then you can substitute it next year. But if people are expecting certain things, you do not mess with their memories. And I will tell you, Thanksgiving and for the Jewish people, Passover are the two things that you can add to but don't subtract. And I always tell people Thanksgiving is the one holiday that if you put an extra carb on the table, nobody notices. For sure.
And everybody's happy if there are leftovers, right?
Actually, they're very upset if there aren't any leftovers, which is I know many people who go to somebody else's house for Thanksgiving. And then they go home, and the next day they make a turkey and some of the major components to the dinner just because there aren't any leftovers in their home.
So they can have sandwiches all week.
Right, right. Which I have to say brings up, since you've been talking about latkes, we're talking about tradition, one of the biggest questions I've been asked, practical questions, actually, I got the first email at the beginning of October. Mm-hmm. Oh, my goodness, Tina, what am I going to do? I've got all this food I'm cooking for Thanksgiving. How am I going to possibly be able to make my latkes and be able to serve them? Because it can mess up the kitchen, you know, or it shouldn't be time consuming, but it can be. So my best piece of advice to everybody listening is that you can make your latkes today.
Really? And freeze them?
Absolutely. But there is a way to do it right. And so that, you know, I would like to do my public service announcement right now.
All right. So what do we do?
Okay. You can fry them the way you normally do. You drain them well on paper toweling. And by the way, I crumple my paper towels because it creates more surface area.
Yeah.
Well, you could layer 20 paper towels, and as soon as you put one latke down or one fried anything, people, fried chicken or anything, the grease is going to go through all 20 layers. So once it's at room temperature, then you take it and you freeze it on a lined cookie sheet, so you'll be able to pull it off the cookie sheet. So freeze them individually.
Mm-hmm.
Once they're frozen solid, you put them in a freezer bag. Now, don't put them in a sandwich bag because that's what you have, and then write me and complain that it's gotten mushy and
you need that thicker
you
bag.
Need, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And then I close it almost all the way, put a straw in it, and suck all the air out. It's the water crystals in the air that become ice, pierce your food, change the flavor of your food, and sometimes change the consistency. And this is something I do with baked goods. I do it with everything.
A little homemade vacuum.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And trust me, I was given a gift of a regular vacuum one, and you have to be very careful because that can flatten your best bread into nothing.
Tina Wasserman is with us. We are talking about her new cookbook, Entree to Judaism for Families, Jewish Cooking and Kitchen Conversations with Children. She's got a signing this afternoon from 1:30 to 3:30 at the Barnes & Noble at Preston and Royal. If you'd like to join the conversation, maybe ask a question, tell a story about your own favorite holiday dish, our number is 1-800-933-5372, and the email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with cooking instructor and author Tina Wasserman. Her new cookbook is called Entree to Judaism for Families, Jewish Cooking and Kitchen Conversations with Children. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Okay, so we've got our latkes frozen, but then we have to reheat them. I'm guessing...
Absolutely.
Microwave is not the way to go.
No. The easiest way and the simplest way is to put them on a cookie sheet frozen,
mm-hmm.
and in a 400 or 425 degree oven, 5 minutes. They'll be crisp. They'll be wonderful.
More oil or anything?
Nothing. Mm-hmm. If you've done it correctly, that's the way it will work.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Another thing I saw in the book that interested me was kugels, which is something that I actually grew up eating. And I think we ate the bread version that is very sweet, but there are several with noodles. And talk about a little bit about the history of that and why there are so many variations.
Well, the variations had a lot to do with what was readily available, you know, and the regions and, you know, and in as people became more prosperous, they had milled flour, and the milled flour could be made into noodles and et cetera, et cetera. What I do want to point out is that the very first kugel, and kugel means pudding, the very first kugel was actually, and you can go to the Czech Republic to this day and eat it, and it's like a ball of dough. It's plain, and I go,
Nothing, no enhancements?
Nothing. But the reason it's no enhancements is it was originally put into what was called a Kugeltopf, and it was like a little ceramic dish, and that was put in the center of the Sabbath stew that was then sealed and put over the embers and cooked for about 12 hours. You know, overnight.
Yeah.
So the very first kugel was actually a bread kugel. So again, when everybody's been asking me, oh, what do we do? I said, you don't have to do anything differently for Thanksgiving. You can just look at the table and see Jewish history through, or at least find connection throughout it. So if you do a bread stuffing, you know, that's essentially like a Kugeltopf. So you're fine with that, you know, and you don't have to do anything unusual. Although I will say in the book, I have one that people might think is very sophisticated for children, but they love it. It has dried fruit and nuts and a little Madeira in it, and it's just wonderful. And, you know, an onion and mushroom, of course, you know. How could it not have onion in it? But it's – so that was the first kugel. The next kugels were the noodle kugels. And then, you know, and then some were dairy and some were didn't have any dairy product in it. And then and then there was rice kugel. As a matter of fact, my husband's grandmother used to make kugel that you cut it into squares. You know, I used to think, oh my goodness, she cooked it too long, although it goes like that. but that was rice kugel. And I created a recipe that actually you cook it and it has a little bit of custard layer on top. After it bakes, the custard comes to the top. And then the last kugel was potato kugel. So then I listen to people saying, oh, can we make latke stuffing? I go, yeah, a.k.a. it's potato kugel. You know, I mean, it's no different. It's the same recipe. So, you know, so that's the history of kugel throughout the ages, so to speak.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Catherine in Dallas. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, Chris. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Good. Great show. Tina, this is a shout out from your neighbor Catherine.
Oh, hi.
Hey, but I do have a comment, and that is, I don't know if you realize this, there are two recipes that you shared many, many years ago when you did a cooking class for your neighbors that have become Thanksgiving and Christmas holiday standards for our family table. One of them is the cranberry relish. And the other is the pumpkin bread. There are a jillion different kinds of pumpkin breads out there, but yours really is the best. And this time of year, I'm making both of those as often as I can. So thank you very much.
Oh, you're very
nice to hear from you, Catherine.
You're very welcome. Actually, there are the two quick stories with that. When people said to me, when people say, well, what can we look for on the table that's Jewish? And I said, well, you could do the apple pear cranberry relish with Grand Marnier and orange juice and talk about the history of Jews in the orange trade. And they looked at me like, really? You know, and I go, but the best story about the relish is every year somebody says to me, Tina, I have the best recipe for cranberry relish. And I go, really? Tell me about it. As long as it's cooked, you know. And so they go, oh, yeah, it's got apples and pears. And I go,
is that your recipe?
Yeah, and listen, and I'm laughing my head off. It's made the rounds. So it's no longer anybody's recipe, and everybody enjoys it, and I'm thrilled, you know. But it's really funny how it, you know, spread that way. And the pumpkin bread recipe, I was teaching. I started out as a junior high school home economics teacher in Mineola. Long Island. And I used to let the students have lunch in my classroom rather than just go to the cafeteria or for me go to the teacher's lounge. And so we were there one day, and this young woman, Joanna Orlando, was eating something. I said, Joanne, what are you eating? She says, oh, it's pumpkin bread. I said, what's pumpkin bread? She gave me a taste. And I tasted it, and I looked at her very seriously. I go, Joanne, do you want to pass home ec? She goes, yes. I was Miss Rice at the time. She says, yes. I said, you better bring the recipe in. And to this day, I have it on the card that she wrote it in my little file box that I save for mementos. So I'm glad that it's passed on to you, Catherine.
It's amazing the way recipes sort of travel from one person to another. I did not know until I read this book that there was a Jewish history to the bundt pan, which everybody has in their kitchen. Some people pull them out all the time. Some people pull them out every 5 years, but everybody's got one.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The it was the like 1949, 1950, and three Jewish women were sitting at their Hadassah meeting in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and one woman was bemoaning the fact that her grandmother's Kugelhopf pan – not Kugeltopf, this is Kugelhopf pan, was starting to disintegrate, and she couldn't find another one anyplace. And the other woman, one of the other women said, well, I have a neighbor who makes utensils out of aluminum. He owns a company called Nordicware. So she said, let's see if he'll do something. So they showed him the pan. He created the pan. And he had a few seconds, you know, the seconds, the ones that didn't come out perfect, he gave to these Hadassah ladies to start to, raise some money. And that's how it was created. But it was called a Bund pan, B-U-N-D, which meant community or festivity. But it was 1950, and we had just come out of World War II, and the Bund was associated with Hitler.
Sounded too German.
Right. Mm-hmm. So he put a T at the end of it. So it's a Bundt pan.
That's such an amazingly American story.
Yes.
I love it for exactly that reason.
Yes.
Let's go next on the phone to Kim in Plano. Hey, Kim.
Hey, how you doing?
Very well. Thank you.
I have a great idea for the leftovers for Thanksgiving. Last year, a bunch of friends came over, and we decided to go out and buy a bunch of little small pie tins. And so for the leftovers, we had the dough. And we took all the leftovers and made turkey pot pies, put the dough over them, wrapped them up, and sent everyone home with a little takeaway gift to pop in their freezer. And we didn't have to deal with all the Tupperware and all the different things and come up with leftover ideas.
That's a nice idea.
That's a very clever idea. I mean, I'm amazed that you could put it all together while they were still there. But that they probably helped. So that was very good, too. Although I must say I would miss some of the leftovers.
You got to make a big one for yourself.
You're stuffed at Thanksgiving, you know, especially if you've eaten during halftime or something like that. You know, and then about 10 o'clock at night, you can't understand why you're hungry again.
let's go back.
Thank you for sharing that.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Brad on the line in Sherman. Hey, Brad.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Hi.
When I was a child, we used to help, the kids would help our grandmother make potato kugel.
Uh-huh.
And I remember it being just real heavy and real greasy. And part of the process was us kids taking the potato and manually pushing it against the grater, and most of the time we'd end up grating half of our fingers, which I thought was probably most of the tradition anyway, but it was a lot of fun.
Extra flavor.
Really, thank you.
Well, Brad, you said they were heavy and greasy. Did you love them anyway, or was it just something you guys ate?
Oh, the heavier and the greasier, the better.
Do you have the recipe, or do you need the recipe?
I would like to have the recipe. I do not have it.
Okay. I would like to venture a couple of guesses. Okay. Let me ask you this. Did she use bread or did she use matzah meal in it?
You know what? All I remember was the potato. I'm sure there was some matzah meal. I don't think she used bread.
Okay. Well, then the matzah meal would explain part of it. Matzah meal absorbs moisture. And it can bind things together, but it absorbs an inordinate amount of moisture, so that if she was a little heavy-handed with it, looking at the potato and saying, oh, with the onion juice, because I presume there was grated onion in there, right?
Yes, there was, Brad. Sorry.
Yes, I think there was.
Yeah, okay. So she saw all that water and she said, oh, I've got to add more matzo meal. Well, the trick with matzo meal, and if you can remember this Passover, that's a very important tip, is that you have to give it a few minutes to hydrate. Mm-hmm. Because if you keep adding matzo meal, waiting for it to be the consistency you want visually, it is not going to be the consistency. Well, it might be the consistency you want later on. So if you're going to make it to recreate your grandmother's, I would suggest that you probably will use an inordinate amount of matzo meal. So try that. And she probably didn't grease the pan so much as poured oil into the pan. And then it comes up the sides and greases, because I have a recipe in this book for a Persian cuckoo, which is it is more like a frittata. But it calls for adding 2 tablespoons of oil, greasing the pan with 2 tablespoons of oil, which is an inordinate amount, it appears to be anyway. But what it does is it actually fries the bottom and the sides so that they're crispy, and there I think you might have the extra grease that way.
You were talking about the strange properties of matzo meal.
Mm-hmm.
We should say you are a fan of Hellman's mayonnaise here. It shows up multiple times, but not the low-fat version.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. If you want to use low-fat mayonnaise on your sandwich bread or whatever, that's fine. The reason it's low-fat is cellulose is added to give it that consistency, and water is added because the cellulose absorbs the water. Well, if you're making any food with that, the low-fat variety, then, like, let's say you're making chicken salad, then you make it, it looks moist, delicious, you put it in the refrigerator, you go to serve it, and it's clumped up because it's hydrated. The cellulose has absorbed that moisture, and now it's gloppy. So I you know, for the amount that you use, I wouldn't worry about it. I think that, the joke is that if you were to do a survey of homes, Jewish homes, I would say that there would be an inordinate number, and Unilever is going to love me for this, but this is not a paid political announcement, I promise, is that Hellman's mayonnaise has always been in Jewish homes. Now, it turns out in my research, I found out that Richard Hellman, and it's 2 N's, he came from Germany, so and Unilever actually hired an archivist, because I called them up and asked them.
Wow.
And they hired an archivist to find out the answer to this. Was Richard Hellman Jewish? I have no idea. They have no idea. That's fine. But in any case, he came over in 1904. He met a woman named Nina. Her father was in the deli business. He opened up a deli on the Upper West Side, and Nina used to make 2 sauces. And he used to use them as spreads on bread and in his salads. And there was one sauce that was even more popular than the other one. And he started bottling it, and he called it Hellman's Best. Bingo. That's the origin of Hellman's mayonnaise.
So it does have a nice, like, deli origin. That's kind of
absolutely
nice. All right, so there is, we won't have time to give the whole recipe, but there is actually a dessert in this book that contains Hellman's mayonnaise.
Yes, and I call it mystery mandelbread. Mandelbread means almond bread, but it's biscotti to you know, everyone else. But I call it mystery, and one of the stories I tell at the beginning of the recipe is why Hellman's is using that. During World War II, there was a shortage of fat products. They were using them, obviously, for the armed services more than anything. And so Hellman's was substituted in cakes and in bread. So this is actually a biscotti that's made with Hellman's mayonnaise.
Tina Wasserman's new cookbook is called Entree to Judaism for Families, Jewish Cooking and Kitchen Conversations with Children. She's got a signing at the Barnes & Noble at Preston & Royal at 1:30 this afternoon until 3:30.
And the cookies will be there. I actually made some to pass out.
Excellent, excellent. Tina, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and Christine McConnell prepares our podcast. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.